Welcome to KABU, Emily Johnston.
Thank you, Jen.
Well, in 2016, you were part of a coordinated action across four states to shut down oil pipelines, and you have come to be known as the Valve Turners. Last month, you and two of the other Valve Turners went on trial in Bagley, Minnesota, enlisting the necessity defense. And the acquittal that resulted from that trial has been confusing to many, and I'd like us to talk about how you see the outcome, especially after a month of reflection. But first, let's talk about the action itself and the aim behind it, and I think the plan of coordinating the action across four states.
Sure. So we decided, you know, when we decided that we needed to do something sort of dramatic in order to highlight the dangers of climate change and try to get this system, which is so clearly stuck, a little bit unstuck, we decided that we really had to target either tar sands or coal, because those are the worst in terms of emissions. And tar sands in the pipelines, you know, seemed like a very logical target. And then we also realized that there were only five of them coming into the United States, five pipelines of tar sands bitumen. There's a little bit more that's refined.
These toxic oils that are produced in northern Alberta.
Exactly. Yeah, and they basically clear cut and destroy the equivalent of a Scotland sized piece of the boreal forest in Canada, ripping it up in order to get at the mucky tar sands beneath, which they have to use quite a lot of energy to extract it because it is so mucky. They have to make it flow. They have to use lots of chemicals, lots of hot water to make it flow into pipelines. And so, yeah, so we decided that, you know, with a small number of people, we could instigate the shutdown of all of those pipelines. And that's what we decided to do. So, and that's what we did on October 11th, 2016, in four states. There were two pipelines right next to one another in Minnesota, where I was with Annette Fasting and Ben Jeldersma, our support person. And then there was the Keystone pipeline in North Dakota, the Keystone One, and the then Spectra pipeline in Montana, and the Kinder Morgan pipeline in Washington State.
Part of what was compelling about this action was it did highlight the whole coordinated system of oil pipelines throughout North America. I think often there's a news focus, a kind of riveting interest in the Dakota Access Pipeline or the Keystone XL pipeline. And here and there you see action around one of the pipeline sites, but you really drew onto the stage, media stage, this network through, and the call for coordinated action against the whole system of oil pipelines.
Sure, yeah. One thing that was highlighted immediately by Reuters was that we actually caused the shutdown of 15%, the equivalent of 15% of U.S. daily oil use, which was very striking to us. We had not realized that would be the case. And so, you know, if five people, basically, can shut down that much of our oil use for the day, it just sort of highlights the fact that these companies cannot operate without our consent. You know, they have literally millions of miles of pipeline, across the country. They have, of course, the oil trains, they have ships and tankers and all kinds of things. So, and they have to come through our communities, through our farmland, everything else. And so, you know, if people really decide that it's unacceptable for us to keep barreling towards, climate apocalypse in the way that we're doing now, you know, we do actually have a lot of power because we can stop these things from moving easily. We can stop them from moving at all for periods of time. And in doing so, you know, we can really highlight the problem and the fact that we need a systemic solution.
The action was both symbolic and prefigurative in the sense of engaging in an interruption of a process that
right.
calls for massive interruption and
exactly.
blocking the path of these very aggressive pipeline companies. Now, the actions are sometimes presented on the news as a kind of spontaneous outrage, but in pursuing the necessity defense and planning this action, there's quite a bit to consider, and some of the reasoning behind it was at the center of the trial in Bagley, Minnesota last month. Can you speak to the use of the necessity defense and that this as a relatively new strategy in the climate movement?
Yeah, well, so I wouldn't call it a, yeah, it's, I don't think it's new so much. I mean, a lot of people have been trying this over a period of years, and it's certainly not new in the sense of, you know, people tried this successfully, you know, with regard to like demonstrations at nuclear installations, et cetera. So this is the kind of case where people try to raise necessity defense. And we specifically did this action in part because it would allow us, you know, because it happened in four states, it would allow us four chances to get the necessity defense. And only in Minnesota were we, in fact, granted it. You have to be allowed to pursue that defense.
At a jury trial.
Yeah, and of course, what's normally the case is you are, it, the only question is, did you break the law, you know? And because we live-streamed it and because we were very open about exactly what we'd done and how we'd done it, then, you know, we had to persuade the judge that it, whether or not we broke the law, but why we broke the law. And, you know, we, there was a whole separate hearing in August, you know, a year and a half ago, as to persuade the judge, in essence, that, that we had a reasonable belief that what we did was necessary. And you have to prove several different things. You have to prove that the harm you were trying to prevent was greater than the harm that was caused by your breaking the law. You had to prove that the harm was imminent, that you had no other available options that might work other than breaking the law, and that you had reason to believe that what you did might be effective at helping to solve the harm. So that's a pretty high bar. You know, one of the classic examples of the necessity defense is if you're walking by a burning building and you hear a baby crying from inside, you're completely and totally allowed to break and enter. You can break down the door and try and get the baby out because the baby dying is a greater harm than the fact if you're breaking and entering. And so essentially what we were saying is, all the world's babies are in this burning building, and we have to break down the door now. Like, we have tried everything else. People have been trying for decades to approach this problem, you know, using legal methods, and we're not getting anywhere. And we know we are flat running out of time. And, you know, the UN climate chief said something in the September about, we have a year and a half to be on a path of radical, you know, emissions reductions. It was phrased somewhat differently with the most recent IPCC report. But the fact is, like, we need to be changing our ways now in really deep, systematic, and as the IPCC also said, historically unprecedented transformation is what we need right now. And, you know, that was very apparent when we did the action 2 years ago as well. So
The acquittal was celebrated by some and announced as a victory, but you were not able to present a full necessity defense and at trial. Can you describe the ruling of the judge, the outcome of the trial, and your thoughts about it now?
Yeah, so two different things happened, and they tend to get conflated. But so, you know, the judge granted us the necessity defense, and the judge had from last summer, a year and a half ago, you know, a full list of our necessity defense witnesses, knew exactly the kind of case we intended to present, and all systems were go. So when I arrived in Minnesota, you know, a couple weeks before the trial, because there was a pretrial hearing too, you know, we all thought that we knew exactly what the trial was going to look like, and it was going to be so, so important. I thought it was going to be perhaps the most important thing I would ever do with my life is that week of trial. And that's not so much because of what we would get to say, but because our expert witnesses were people like, you know, James Hansen, the former head of, you know, NASA's Goddard Space Lab. And so, you know, we were also bringing people who would talk quite explicitly about why civil disobedience is helpful, you know, when it has been helpful in the past, and how it helps to shift sort of deep-rooted problems, and people who would talk about, like, the reasons we had no other alternatives because, you know, our system is currently so sort of bought and paid for by the fossil fuel industry. And anyway, so we had extremely persuasive witnesses lined up to speak for us, people with a lot of authority who could speak very eloquently to why this kind of action is necessary now. And then 4 days before the trial, the judge all of a sudden, out of nowhere, said that we could not have any necessity defense witnesses. We could not have anybody speaking about climate change, anybody speaking about why there are no alternatives, anybody speaking about how civil disobedience can be effective. And this was completely surreal. Nobody saw this coming in any way, shape, or form. Even the prosecutor had only asked that we be allowed fewer witnesses because they were afraid of the cumulative effect of those expert witnesses. So, you know, this was, you know, it was gobsmacking, basically. We didn't know what to do about it. We thought it was, you know, impossible and it was going to shift. And we were just trying to figure out how we could salvage having some of our expert witnesses be able to speak to these things. Because, you know, I'm a poet from Seattle. My friend Annette is a retired tribal lawyer. Why on earth would a jury in Northwest Minnesota believe us about the urgency of climate change? You know, the former head of NASA, that's a different story altogether, right? And so, you know, and we also had the guy who wrote the pipeline safety manual who was going to say that we were preventing harm. And so, you know, but again, without those witnesses to speak for us, our case was completely gutted. So we were devastated and just trying to figure out, you know, how we could possibly salvage some portion of it. And then, you know, the jury was seated on Monday. The prosecution.
So, Emily, we're going to close in shortly, but I would like to have you on the Old Mole again as your work continues. And just to conclude, the you were acquitted, but that you were not able to present the necessity defense and the experts you had scheduled. So you had the rug pulled out from under you, and there's many speculations on why that happened, but the work continues and has achieved even more urgency. And this action, which was what's described as a high legal risk action, is also requires other kinds of actions in support of it. And thank you for your good work and for being here on the show today, Emily Johnston. And we all honor you and all of the other activists engaged in civil disobedience.
Thank you, Jan.
Thank you so much, Jan.
Thanks, Jan and Emily Johnston.